Week number 10, sexuality. This I decided to actually devote an entire week to because this comes up so frequently. It's emphasized in Scripture, both that it's brought up over and over and over, that it's described in different ways, and also that there's emphatic language for our sexuality being a moral component to following the Lord. And yet this is also an area that quickly takes people out. We've studied our surveys of people that we've led to Christ over the last couple years, and we see that the people who have left fellowship, most of them, it's over this issue. They can't get their sexuality under control. Instead, it's actually controlling them. And so we want to devote the next entire class until we're finished here to look at this topic. Let's start with an important facet of this, which would be porno. Pornography is a booming business. Porn sites are visited 3 times more often than Google, Yahoo, and MSN search combined. The porn business brings in more money than pro football, pro basketball, pro baseball, pro racing combined. There is nothing like this business in the United States. This has become the new American pastime, is pornography. And since the advent of the internet, which has brought such a wealth of information and it's been such a great good, the porn business has just exponentially increased. Children, for the most part these days, are getting their first exposure to porn at age 11. So this is actually before puberty even hits. 11 years old. Most Christian dads you talk to, their son or their daughter is 13 or 14 years old when they decide, well, I suppose it's about time to give them the talk about sex. Well, it was the time. It was the time a couple years ago. They were seeing this. They were finding out about this long before you got around to having this conversation. Pornography is really a triple threat. It's anonymous, it's accessible, and it's affordable. This has all changed since the advent of the internet. And I'm not a technophobe, right? I'm not afraid of technology. Technology's good. We just need to come face to face with this plight that's confronting us. Since the internet has appeared, pornography has become anonymous. 30 years ago, if you wanted porn, you'd have to go down to a seedy porn store. And as you went in, you'd have the phony nose and glasses on and the hoodie up and the scarf around your face. And you had to kind of sneak in. Or maybe it was a video rental place. Do you guys remember what those were? Blockbuster Video. Usually it was these private owned video stores where you'd have to go into a certain room. I remember being a kid walking into Starflix, which was like a privately owned video rental. And there was a little room off the back of the building, and there was a little seedy, weird-looking curtain, and you'd see people going into there and going out of there, and that's where they kept the porn. Today, you don't have to worry about somebody seeing you going into a weird-looking part of the video rental store. You don't have to worry about that at all. Having some kind of a record, pornography has become completely anonymous. No one knows about it. What happens in the privacy of my office, bedroom, whatever, that's it. It's become accessible. Again, the same principle would apply. If you were looking to get into some porn, you would have to get in your car, scrape the snow off the windshield, drive down to rent a video. Today, incredibly accessible. I've counseled dozens of men on this topic. And one of the things they complain about frequently is that it's just one click away. They'll be looking at their fantasy football. They'll be checking email, Facebook. And it's just all you need to do to fall into it is just one click. It's also affordable. Used to be pornography counselors, sex counselors, used to work with people who were going bankrupt because of their porn addiction. They'd get into a new tape, a new video. It's nothing like that today. Paying for porn, that is just kind of a strange concept for most people. Today, you can get as much porn as you want, as long as your hard drive can fit it, and your wireless connection can download it. That's how quickly you can have access to multitudes of porn. What we've seen is a sociological shift in the last 20 years. As the porn industry has blossomed and boomed, this has had a huge effect, not just on men, on women as well. About 20% of porn users are female. When I first entered college ministry, there was nothing like that. No women would do it, or more likely would talk about doing it. It wasn't a thing. It wasn't something that women would share. Today, this has become normal. It's become normative for this not just being an issue for the men. This is an issue for the women as well. Pornography has a horrible effect on the mind. This is like a poison. As we get into this is like ripping back your scalp and putting a stamp right onto your brain, right onto your soul. Now, I'm going to say everything here in relationship to men, because I just don't want to do the gender neutral thing. So ladies, you're going to have to correct my language in your own mind. Apologies. Porn objectifies women. What do we mean by objectifies women? You hear that term quite a bit. What does it mean to objectify? It means to make something an object. So looking at a woman in porn, no longer is this a person with whom you'd have a relationship. This is someone who is an object. As one author put it, pornography has reduced women down to like Kentucky Fried Chicken. Breasts, thighs, and legs. I thought that was really insightful. It's basically just shapes. Men go through this kind of stuff, just looking, comparing what's better, what's worse. It's like you're looking at cars. It's like you're looking at objects. We see as people further indulge in porn, they gain a higher tolerance for abnormal or deviant sex. So, to put it a different way, the more porn you watch, you're looking for something crazier. It's not enough just to see nudity. You need to see, and I'm just not going to go into the details, it needs to be rougher, it needs to be harder, it needs to be a little bit weirder, until you see people that have become addicted to this, where it just becomes so strange, this is no longer even remotely like sex at all, if it ever was in the first place. Here's a study done by Jennings Bryant and Dolph Zillman. These were both psychologists at Northeastern University. This comes out of the Journal of Applied Social Psychology. They had four different groups of college students. In the first group, this was titled the Massive Exposure Group. This is where this particular group of people were brought together. They had to view 48 minutes of porn per week, 7 minutes a day, every day, for 6 weeks, for a month and a half. This was considered to be the massive exposure group. In the fourth group, on the other end of the spectrum, they watched no porn. That was the control group. Then the second and third group was somewhere in between. This is what they found. At the end of the study, in the final day, the massive exposure group believed that 3 in 10 Americans engaged in group sex. In reality, only 1 in 10 engaged in this practice. So they asked the massive exposure group, how many people do you think engage in group sex? 3. Actually, it was just 1. You asked the fourth group, they said it was under 1. They didn't think it was that many. Bryant and Zillman noted that the massive exposure group also estimated that twice as many people engaged in sadomasochism, that would be like, you know, physical punishment to the body during sex, as well as bestiality. At the end of it, the control group, group four, thought it was under. Group one, the massive exposure group, said twice as much. The massive exposure group was significantly less likely to want daughters than those who had not viewed porn. Now think about that. After watching 7 minutes of porn per day for 6 weeks, it was group number one, the people who were the massive exposure group, when they asked them, would you like to have a daughter someday? They're like, no. Why would you? Why would you? If you're looking at women, that's somebody's daughter. And so it created in them this desire not to even have a girl. 60% who didn't view porn considered marriage an important institution. This was group four, the group that didn't look at it. Yeah, marriage is a good thing. Group one found that only 39% of those people thought marriage was a good thing. Way different, 20% less. Finally, in the end session, they read the four different groups a story. It was a written account from a newspaper of a woman who had been brought in from hitchhiking. There was a man who had picked up a female young girl, college girl, for hitchhiking, puts her in the car, messes her up, rapes her, ties and binds her. I mean, they go into the real lurid description of this abuse. Then they ask the different groups, what do you think the punishment should be for that rapist? What they found is men who had viewed massive amounts of porn recommended significantly shorter sentences for the rapist, an order of about half. The group who didn't view porn said that person should get, you know, 60 years in prison versus 30 years. This study, which was done in 1988, was actually so controversial that they haven't been able to replicate it because it's so ethically distorted that you would bring in these normal people and it would have that kind of an effect on them. It would be so serious, so detrimental to the person, they haven't been able to go back and redo this. Now, I just want you to think about this for a second. How many minutes of porn was the massive exposure group watching? 7 minutes. Let me tell you something. When you start to counsel people on this subject, 7 minutes is nothing. People who are considered massive exposure under this study wouldn't even compare to porn users today. This was back in the 80s. Today, this would be way worse. I know men, they will look at porn for 2 or 3 hours straight, constantly searching for the next clip, the next video, the next strange thing to get them off. Porn also leads to a violent view of sex. Pamela Paul, a secular researcher in her book Pornified, she notes that in 25% of porn magazines, there is a violent perception of sex. It's not just nudity. It's not just sex. It is trying to hurt the person. She notes in 27% of movies, there is a violent overtone to the sex. And 42% of internet porn has violence combined with sex. You know, the same neurochemical reactions that occur during sex also occur during fear or during violence. So that feeling you get when you watch a horror movie or a porno, very similar, not in the net effect, but in the chemicals that it's juicing up. It's adrenaline. It's getting amped up. So to combine these two things, sex and violence. Now, I don't want to go into too much detail here as well. If you want a very good critique of this, pick up Gail Deans, Gail D-I-N-E-S. She's a feminist researcher. And what's interesting is the feminists are partners with Christians on this topic because feminists hate porn. Christians hate porn. So we've become kind of bedfellows, you might say. Gail Deans, that was a good pun, wasn't it? Gail Deans goes through what porn was like back in 1950. Decade by decade by decade up until today. And she goes on to describe just how, I mean, the things that they're doing in these movies have nothing to do with pleasure for the man. What they do have to do with is degradation for the woman. I mean, she shows examples of this where she'll just say, how could that be anything other than just violence on that woman? That's all it is, violence. There's a whole strain of pornography that is moving in this direction. She goes through it in quite a chilling way. That's kind of where this is heading. It distorts what sex really is. Sex is not a violent thing you're doing to somebody. It's not sex. It's not a clear, accurate picture. So then when you try and go out and actually get sex, it never lives up to what that video was like. Porn creates impossible expectations for women. You can never live up to what a porn star is like. And if you could, that would be a problem. There'd be something strange. Norman Doidge is a medical doctor. He points out they reported men who are into pornography increasing difficulty in being turned on by their actual sexual partners, spouses, or girlfriends, though they still considered them objectively attractive. So do you see what he's saying? A guy has a hot girlfriend, beautiful, thinks she's sexy, watches a bunch of porn, and yet he can't get turned on by her any longer. They asked him why. So do you think she's ugly now? You don't think she's pretty? He says, no, I still objectively know that she's hot. It's just something's different. Doidge points out, when I asked if this phenomenon had anything to do with the relationship to viewing pornography, they answered it initially helped them get more excited during sex, but over time, it had the opposite effect. Couples using porn to spice up their sex life. Yeah, at first, whoa, that's interesting. I like that. And you start to engage with that kind of thing, but then you can't just have sex with your mate any longer. Instead, you have to anchor it into a third party, into a screen, into a fiction. And if that component isn't there, it just loses its luster. Pornography also produces an on-demand view of sex. On-demand in the sense that it's right now. You don't have to wait. You don't have to put any kind of work in. Women in porn, always ready to have sex. That's the premise of every porn, is that there's just women out there looking to have sex with men. The term no never exists in a porno. It's always yes. Every time you get into your computer, look at a video, it's always going to say yes, every single time. Women in pornography will have sex however, wherever, whenever the man wants to. Now just think of how deviant that is from sex in the context of marriage or with a person, an actual human being, flesh and blood, that I'm just going to expect my mate to turn on, have sex wherever I want, however I want, at any time. You can see this would lead to huge problems. Users of pornography don't need relational capital. They don't need a job. They don't even need personal hygiene. They don't need to brush their teeth. They don't need to shower. They don't need to keep themselves together. Think of how different that is to have the expectation of sex, even though we're not putting any kind of work into this person. There was a counselor who said, for those of us who are going to get married, which is the majority here, 90% or more, before you can touch your wife's body, you have to touch her soul and you have to touch her mind. With porn, it's completely opposite. You can just get direct access to the body, the spiritual dimension, the intellectual dimension, relational dimension is completely absent. We're just going right for the gusto. Leads to a dehumanizing view of women. Let's compare sex and porn versus biblical, healthy sex. In unhealthy sex, it's I'm using somebody. In healthy sex, it's I'm caring for somebody. I'm not just using the person. In unhealthy sex, I'm doing it to you. Healthy sex, I'm doing this with you. This is something we're sharing together. Porno sex is compulsive. Healthy sex, natural. Healthy. This is something that we get to do. This isn't something I feel like I'm expected to do any second. It's like a compulsive habit. If I get this feeling, this is something I have to let out. Unhealthy sex, separate from love. We don't even need to love the person. How many times do you see in a sex scene, I love you. I really care about you. Oh, I just feel so connected with you. No, nothing like that. Healthy sex is an expression of love. Biblically, this is the one flesh. This is actually a way for married couples to build intimacy. One of the things you can do if you're lacking intimacy is hit the sack together. You get closer. You build in with one another. Unhealthy sex, distant. You're using the person and leaving. Healthy sex, close, intimate. Unhealthy, on demand. Healthy, certain conditions. This isn't something I just do to you. It's something that we have talked about. We have built in with each other. Finally, unhealthy sex builds shame and guilt, fear. Healthy sex builds self-esteem. It's actually a nice component of self-esteem and confidence. God has given this as a gift to build us up. When it's misused, this is something that actually shatters the soul. Many of us here have been through this, where you've been through this personally, where you feel like you've actually lost something. You've lost esteem with other people. Here's an insight from Gail Deans. She says that if you look at pornography, now I haven't looked at pornography for 5.5 years, or I don't even know how long. But Deans is keeping up on this, and she's a feminist. She keeps up on the literature. She points out, if you look at the language used of women in porn, what are women called? Ladies? Sweet girls? Something like that? No. They're called what? Fresh meat. Dirty. Nasty. Filthy. Whores. Sluts. And she goes into a bunch of other expletive names I won't even repeat, okay? Yeah, this girl's a real fill-in-the-blank. One of the things Deans points out is this. You know, back during the Holocaust, what was part of the propaganda piece used to convince normal people that Jews were subhuman? They used language. That Jew, that's a rat. That's a filthy rat. Or it's a kike. Or it's a, you know, they would come up with racial slurs. Think of African Americans. All of the racial epithets have been used. It's basically a way of using a term to dehumanize that person or group. Deans points out, I think rightly, this is exactly what people are doing when it comes to porn. How is it that so many men can look at a woman half their age or their age, whatever, undressing for them, doing all sorts of despicable crap, and view that as though it's totally okay, like it's not that big of a deal? Part of it could be this piece that you can't look at them like they're made in the image of God. You have to degradate the person into thinking they're just a shape, they're just a slut. They're just a filthy whatever. Here is a concept we should consider. Is pornography a drug? In the simplest classification, no. Depending on how you classify it, yes. Pornography would be considered a drug. Pamela Paul points this out in Pornified. She says in one study, men who were shown pornographic films for 90 minutes a day 5 days a week experienced less sexual arousal and interest in similar materials with the passage of time. We're only talking about for 5 days a week, 90 minutes. That is a big exposure to porn. After a certain point, it could be a different video. It could be a different, I don't want to call him an actress, but a different person in the video. And yet, over time, what gets you off today won't get you off tomorrow, or in 2 weeks, or in 2 years. You need to keep raising the bar. So this would be what we would call the principle of vanishing returns, diminishing returns. That what you invest, just think like, you know, drugs. The drug doesn't give you the same effect each time. You need more of the drug, different kinds of drugs, gateway drugs that lead you to further drugs. And over time, you reach the point where, you know, smoking a joint just didn't do it for you the way it used to. Porn could be considered the same way. Paul cites a 2004 poll where 35% of men admitted that real sex had become less arousing, and 20% admitted real sex just couldn't compare to cyber sex. That means one out of five men would rather look through a screen at a fantasy, a fiction, than actually have real sex with a human woman, with an actual person in front of them. In fact, what we've discovered, there was a 2004 Senate hearing where this was brought before the Senate. The person that was arguing showed images of cocaine users and porn users in the precise areas of the brain that lit up for cocaine use. An incredible stimulant, unbelievable stimulant. And porn use both lit up in the same spot. In fact, I brought this video.
No one has ever scanned the brains of porn users who feel like they are addicted. Even Valerie took some convincing.
I wasn't sure what to expect when I first started the study, to be perfectly frank. And in part because we just know so little about it. I was quite skeptical and I was a bit ambivalent about the study.
After a nationwide search, we found 20 men aged 19 to 34 whose lives were so controlled by porn they were willing to take part in our study. They didn't want to be identified, but they were prepared to be scanned by Dr. Boone. They were prepared for the control group of healthy male volunteers. When the data was analyzed, the results were astounding. While the ordinary people were clearly excited by porn, as you'd expect, the compulsive users' brains were twice as active in their ventral striatum, just like addicts responding to drugs or alcohol.
In people who are dependent on nicotine, alcohol, or cocaine, when they're exposed to cues, they end up having an increase in activity. So what we see here is in response to an explicit video. And you see there's a very clear increase in activity in the reward center.
And there was more. The reward networks of the compulsive porn users were lighting up like Christmas trees. Areas involved in anticipating the porn, physically responding to the porn, and prioritizing the porn were all hyperactivated.
That's a really profound difference compared to, you know, these guys whose brains are firing up like fireworks. So it's a very, very profound effect that porn's having on them.
Yeah, it is a very profound effect.
And the reaction that the porn user's having to porn there, they can't control that, can they? They can't affect the outcome.
No, they can't.
If people are saying that porn is addictive, and where's the proof? The proof is the same parts of the brain are firing in the same way. That seems pretty compelling.
Yeah, compulsive pornography users do have parallels with substance use disorders, and that's on several levels. This is easily one of the first studies of its kind. But what I would emphasize is that a lot more work needs to be done.
Dr. Vu's results will form part of a wider study intended for publication in a peer-reviewed journal. But already, the results are painting a pretty scary picture.
Not the early days, but this research seems to show that porn can be addictive. If that's the case, and we allow our children free access to online porn, that's not even heroin lying around the house.
So, we don't want to overstate our case and say that porn addiction is identical to drug addiction. That's not the point they're making. It's not the same in effect, it's the same in kind. It is the same sort of addiction process. There are some men who get so addicted to it that the solution, married men, the solution is not to have any sort of orgasmic activity for 3 months to get their levels back in place. They need complete abstinence, not just from porn, from anything, sex, anything. What we're saying here is, as you saw in that video, seeing the same image, you know, two different men, the beginning user and non-user versus the addict who's addicted to it. Both of these men have different physiological effects in the brain. This is what's called neuroplasticity, which we've talked about before, that your behavior, your thinking will have a physiological effect on your mind, over on your brain over time. Whatever you anchor your orgasmic event in will become normative. You need to go back to that anchor. Orgasm produces bonding hormones, oxytocin, and vasopressin. I tend to think this is God's way of when you find your mate, when you get married, when you have sex with that person, you bond with that person. There's something that happens in men and in women that connects you. Of course, there's the spiritual component that Paul, Jesus, in Genesis, all described, that the two become one flesh. Now, he's not just saying that, like when Paul says in 1 Corinthians 6, the two, if you join your body with the prostitute, don't you know that you will become one flesh with her? I used to think he meant, if you join your body with the prostitute, then you become one flesh physically. That would be redundant, right? I join my body with the prostitute, and so don't you know that you join your body with the prostitute? No. The one flesh there in Hebrew is one spirit. There is a spiritual thing that's happening here. With porn, if you get off to a screen, an illusion, a fiction, you need to go back there. I've counseled men before, married men, who will just get done sleeping with their wife and then go look at porn and masturbate. I mean, it's like, wasn't that good enough? Well, yeah, but I still needed to go back to porn. That was the thing I was really looking forward to. Porn, it actually mimics three different types of drugs. A stimulant, which stimulant drugs, cocaine, speed, these kind of get you amped up. You get revved up for porn. This can actually happen. What we're going to talk about is the ritual process. Is you're starting to plan how, where, when you get into porn. It gets your adrenaline firing. You're getting excited. You're thinking about it. You're getting revved up. This produces dopamine. It's a neurochemical that has an effect on happiness. That's what stimulants do. When you crash off of stimulants, you go into a deep depression. You come off of it and it's bad. Porn's like a hallucinogen. It connects with this part of your brain because what you're seeing in porn, it's different than something you would just imagine. You're actually importing images, sounds, and stuff into your mind. I've talked to men about this as well. they can remember porn that they watched 10 years ago, 15 years ago. They remember the image. They remember what it was like. And it's basically burning these images and thoughts about what sex is into your brain. It's also analogous to a barbiturate. A barbiturate is kind of like the drug that brings you down. If a stimulant is an upper, a barbiturate is a downer. Lets you calm down. When obviously combined with orgasm, porn, it ramps you up, it's a hallucinogen, and then it brings you right back down. Really has components of all three. There's a third, or rather fourth component, which is called the intermittent reward system. In psychology, this refers to when the patient doesn't always get the reward each time. So picture like a bird going up to a lever. And at first, when the bird hits the lever, the pellet comes out, right? And so the bird hits the lever, pellet, likes the pellet, reward. The bird hits the lever, pellet, likes the pellet, reward. Until it learns to hit that lever to get the pellet. Well, sometimes the scientist in the study will have it show up 3 out of 4 times. So the bird hits the pellet, works, hits the pellet, works, hits the pellet, works, fourth, hits the pellet, doesn't work. What do you think the bird's going to do? Hits the lever, you get the point. Okay, then they'll do it 1 out of every other time, and the bird will hit the lever. And then the pellet comes out, or the bird will hit the lever, it won't work. They've been able to work with birds to the point where it will hit that lever hundreds of times. And it's with the anticipation, okay, I hit the lever, I might not actually get the pellet, but I could, until the point where the bird is actually going through exhaustion, just rapidly hitting that lever over and over and over with the hope that that pellet will pop out. Porn is similar. If you're following, if you're tracking with this thinking, this philosophy, okay, as you look at porn at first, it's satisfying, it's interesting. But what gets you off today won't get you off tomorrow. And so what it turns to is what's called the thrill of the hunt. That's where you look at an image, you're objectifying the person. Well, her butt is too flabby, or her boobs are too small, or click on another picture. I don't like this about her, or like that, until it just turns into click after click after click after click. For some people, this goes on for hours long. And it's just like that bird in front of that lever, over and over, looking for that next image, that next thing that's going to connect. Well, that is, I suppose, I would like, as we started tonight's lecture, just to jump into solutions. I actually think it's helpful to build a case. Why are we saying this is such a big deal? It is a big deal. This is something that ruins men in particular. You see guys who are into porn, they can't connect, they can't relate the way that men should be able to. There's a guilty feeling to this. I don't counsel women on this, so I just got to speak for the men. I would tend to think women, this would be the same thing as well. And we got to fight this. When you see houses slip into this, and usually it's when the house, just no one talks about it. It's a bad sign. That usually means no one feels comfortable talking about this anymore. And so we all just entreat ourselves to a conspiracy of silence where we just don't talk about that. And we all have our separate little hiding place we go to do that. And we never share it. So we have to build a case for why this is such a big deal. Biblically it is. We know this. Now the question becomes, how do we get out of this? There is an interesting cycle of pornography. It was developed by Dr. Patrick Carnes. He's an authority in this subject of sex counseling. I'm not sure if he's a Christian. I think he could be. I'm not positive about that. Carnes points out that the cycle is really 4/5-fold. The individual is dealing with shame, guilt, or emotional problems. So just picture yourself, you're feeling guilty, you're feeling depressed, you feel a sense of worthlessness, anxious, angry. You don't feel happy with yourself. You don't feel good in your own skin. So what do you do, according to Carnes? Well, you don't want to think about that, right? Dwelling on those emotions and those feelings. Where's my life going? Why can't I finish school? Why can't I get a good girlfriend or boyfriend? You don't want to think about that. And so this leads to the first stage in Carnes' cycle. He calls this preoccupation. In this stage, you're dealing with the guilt, shame, emotional problems, worthlessness. You don't want to think about it. And so you want to preoccupy yourself. And so you start thinking about something that would be easily accessible, that would make you feel better. And for many people, it's porn. This would be just the thing where they can infatuate themselves, feel happy, not think about it. This leads to the ritual stage, according to Carnes. There's preoccupation. You don't want to think about how you're feeling or how you're doing. This leads to ritual. This is where the guy is sitting in class at 3:30 p.m. He feels crappy. He's not happy with himself. His life isn't going well, whatever. And he starts to preoccupy himself with his ritual. And so he starts thinking, okay, it's 3:30. I'll get home at 5:15. My roommate won't be home. I can go up in my bedroom. I can say I'm taking a nap. I can access it with my phone. I can look at that site. I'll have an hour and a half. And they've already started. They've already lost the battle at that point. You might picture this like walking through the Grand Canyon. Or how about this? Walking near an airport. And as you walk near the airport, you see this fence that's built up. And it says, trespassers will be shot. Do not go past here. Could get run over by plane. Right? That kind of a sign. And as you choose to hop over that fence, at that point, you've already lost the battle. It's at this ritual stage where you start thinking about it and planning it several hours in advance that by the time you reach stage number 3, actually falling into porn, often you find yourself in that situation and you ask yourself, how did I get here? Mark Lasser gives examples of men who are legitimate sexual addicts, where they would go and visit prostitutes. Real extreme examples, right? And he says that men he would counsel, he would say, so when did you have your last fall? And he, last week. What happened? I don't know. He said, I felt like I was on autopilot. I landed in the Houston airport or wherever. I got off the plane. I got in the cab. I got the money, the cash out of the ATM. I visited and saw the prostitute. After it was over, it was like autopilot. It was like, you know, when you fly or when you drive and they, what do they call that? Where it's just like you're in a daze and then 20 minutes later, you're home. Driving coma. There's some kind of a name for it. It's not a technical name, but what is it? Highway hypnosis. Brilliant. Where you get off work and then you're just kind of going through the motions and turn signals. You're not speeding. You're not running anyone over. You get home and then all of a sudden you're there and you're like, I don't remember the last 20 minutes. That's what this is like. You've already planned it. And what they can actually discover is you knew you were going to get into that. You started planning that weeks in advance. Now, to a much, much lesser degree, the same thing is true with falling into porn. This is something you've ritualized, you've planned. When it finally happens, how did I fall into it? It's hopeless. I can't change. Really, it starts back in the ritual stage right there. Well, what happens after you fall into porn? You feel bad. Maybe you feel shame. Maybe you feel guilt. Maybe you have emotional problems. And so what do? Well, I feel terrible. I'm never going to do that again. You make a big vow to God. God, I'll never look at that ever again. I feel terrible. I feel disconnected. And instead of actually dealing with that guilt by breaking the cycle, you fall right back into preoccupation, ritual, falling into porn, despair, and it's cyclical. Counseling pornography. First, as you're working with somebody, I think that cycle, very helpful to attack the ritual stage. Now, actually falling into it is important too, but actually getting the person to think back on how to deal with their preoccupation and ritual, very, very important. Additionally, it's helpful to identify when the individual is vulnerable to porn. Here's a really terrible acronym, but I hope you remember it. Bad halt. You think that's funny? You think my acronym's funny? Bad halt. Bored, anxious, depressed, hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. So going through with the person, oftentimes porno heads, they don't know how they're feeling. How are you feeling? Bad. Okay, what did you feel like before you fell into it this week? Bad. Okay. Use your words. Give me some more. Having a list of things here is actually pretty helpful. Were you feeling bored? Did you have nothing to do? Yeah, I had 5 hours in between when I woke up and then coming out and meeting with somebody. Okay, let's address that. Let's get you a job. Let's get you out of bed before 1 p.m. Anxious. There was a guy I was working with. Every single time exam week came up, if his girlfriend broke up with him, if something really serious, difficult happened that would cause anxiety, I could almost predict that he'd fall into porn. He refused to deal with the anxiety. And in dealing with it, he would go back and binge. I mean, we're talking binge 3 or 4 times a day into porn. Depression. Hungry. I haven't really run into that too much. Although I have been told when I get really hungry, if I hadn't eaten in a long time, I turn into just a total zombie. I look unhappy. It's probably true. Angry, lonely, tired. Also, coming off of a spiritual high. Right after a big retreat or some kind of a big trip, you get home. Is that when you're vulnerable? Think of Elijah, 1 Kings 19. Comes back from fighting the prophets of Baal, and all of a sudden, just a total collapse. So identifying this, let's actually start tackling these issues. If we could address these issues, you know, one of the biggest ones, I think it's interesting, it's at the top of the list, is boredom. Guys not going out, putting their pants on and getting a job, going to work, sitting at home all day in bed. Eventually, you start to think about what you're going to do, and you fall into porn. Let's get you a job. Let's get you working in school. You not working, just sitting at home, laying around. That is going to be a bad recipe for falling into porn. Learn to confess. If you're working with someone, is it that you have to ask them about this issue, or are they talking to you about it? This is a real key to getting out from under this weight. David describes it in Psalm 32, verse 3. He says, "When I refused to confess my sin, my body wasted away and I groaned all day long. Day and night, your hand, God, of discipline was heavy on me. My strength evaporated like water in the summer heat." You ever been there? Where you've had a moral fall and you haven't talked about it. I have dreams like this all the time. We're in the dream a couple weeks ago. In the dream, I had hung out with my old buddy, who's also a sphere leader here, and we had gotten high together. And then we gave some weed to Brandon Grant, who's over at UC. And in the dream, we got high, the three of us. And in the dream, I was just like, I need to confess this. I'm such a hypocrite. I've taught against this. Then I did it. We need to end this. I'm going to bust these guys. And in the dream, I was like really righteous. And then I woke up and I was like, oh, God, whew, this is going to be a good day today. Whew. Not disqualified for ministry. Thank God. You'll have dreams like this where you just feel that weight. One time I'd fallen into sin. After it happened, I just kept thinking, this has got to be a dream. can't believe I did that. And you just feel that weight. You feel that tension. And David was proficient. He was able to line this up with that weight isn't because of people, because people don't know. If you feel shame in the absence of a person, it might be because there is a personal being who sees what happened. He says, your hand of discipline was heavy on me. God will put you through the wire. It's like he's squeezing you, extruding you through a sieve. Like, are you going to open up about this? And you just feel like, my strength evaporated like water in the summer heat. Proverbs 28:13. He who conceals his transgressions will not prosper, but he who confesses and forsakes them will find compassion. Isn't that interesting that, you know, you see something happen with a guy? What's the problem? Why can't they develop any kind of a influence for Christ? They seem like they're doing pretty good, and you just see God doesn't bless what they're doing. Sometimes it's kind of mysterious. You can't really tell why. It could be this. It could be that if you're not dealing with some of these heart issues, God will take you right to the mat and say, in some instances, I'm not going to bless you until you deal with this. Now, thank God he doesn't do this for every issue, because then he'd never be able to bless us with an impact. In fact, I tend to think the bar is pretty low, because you see people, examples of people that start to make an impact for Christ, and you look at their life and you're like, they're just not that righteous of a person. At the same time, I think there are moments, these integrity checks that you reach in your walk, where God is like, no, we don't, you and I aren't going past right here until you deal with this. Let's talk about this. Deal with it. As one author put it, without confession, every Bible teaching you sit under will feel like it's about you and your silence. You'll just be sitting there. The person's talking about grace versus law. They're talking about whatever, and all you can think about is your porn problem. What a terrible way to live your Christian life, quite honestly. Really, what this does is it leads to a life where you're just focused on yourself and your sin. You've never brought this out into the light. You've never talked about it. And so I think Satan uses this. I think he takes the shiv to us and just jabs us. So you're sitting there, you're trying to have an encounter with God. You're trying to connect with him in a Bible study. And the whole time, Satan is right there and he's just working that angle. So you think you can be here and have any kind of an impact when you've got that and you, oh, and so you won't tell anyone. Well, it's not that big of a deal. Oh, it's not that big of a deal. Why can't you just talk about it? It is a big deal. You know it's a big deal, but you won't share. And I think it just turns in from weeks into months, and people just don't talk. And it leads into a real despair. That's where I think a lot of people are on this issue. It's just kind of limping from one thing to the next, not really having liberty and victory in this area. James says, confess your sins to one another and pray for one another so that you may be judged. No, so that you may be healed. Why is it that God calls on me to confess my crap and for you to confess your crap? It's so that we can get people's prayers. You can pray for one another. How about that? What if you had a couple people praying for you with this issue? You don't think that would change it? We definitely change it. And so that you may be healed. There's something about, and if you ever had this happen where you open up about your stuff and you just think, man, this is going to be so terrible. And then you finally just open up and people are so accepting. They connect with you and you just feel that sense of liberty. Oh, that's over with. You claim grace and then it's done. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 10:13, no temptation has seized you except what is common to man. Very, very good verse. When we're stuck in this kind of a sin, we just constantly convince ourselves, well, in a room this big, I'm the only one who's struggling with this. Yet, what does the Word of God say? It says, no temptation has seized you except what is common. Everyone's struggling. We're all limping here. We need each other's help. How about you just open up about it and stop making it a big deal and just share? This is where I'm at here. 3, learn to resist and replace. This is kind of a chicken and the egg issue. If you're into porn every day, once a week, whatever, this is going to affect your relationships. You don't feel close with people. You don't feel like you can be honest with people. Talk about it. Yet, if your relationships suck, you're going to be more likely to get into porn. So which is it? Is it the cause or is it the effect? The answer is yes. It's both. Paul says in 2 Timothy 2:22, here's a good passage. Flee from youthful lusts and pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace. So there's the resisting, it's the fleeing, the lust. I'm getting away from that. I think this is the ritual stage. You know, I know for other people, they could go into that situation. They could allow themselves to go that far. I can't do that. For me, just for me, I'm not going to put that on somebody else. That would be sin. I'm not going to get into that situation where I know I'm going to have a problem getting out of. You're fleeing from it, but you're replacing it with what? Pursuing righteousness, faith, love, and peace with those. This isn't a solitary thing. Me and God with my lust problem doesn't work like that. With those who call on the Lord from a pure heart. Do you see what he's saying? It's we're rejecting that, yet we're pursuing this other thing. When we develop this other piece, to develop relationships with people who call on the Lord from a pure heart, walking Christians. That's what he's talking about. Clear as day. We're going to develop those relationships. We're going to build in with people. And all of a sudden, you start to discover, as I pour into people, this whole thing over here isn't as exciting as it used to be. It's when I'm so used to going for this and people are left over that that's where I feel most comfortable. When you build relationships with fellow believers, this other thing seems to dissipate. 4, helping the person to what we could call count the cost of porn. I had a guy I was working with on this, on his laptop. We discovered, okay, where do you fall into it? Laptop. Okay, so on the top of your laptop with whiteout, with a Sharpie marker, with a post-it note, whatever. I want you to write the top 3 things you have to lose if you get into porn. So you can write out your goals. I aspire to have an influence for Christ. I aspire to teach in this home church. I aspire to influence and mentor younger believers. People it will affect. When you get a spouse, you put her name right there. Put right at the top. So you have to look at that. That will affect her. Relationships. You know, there is a certain sense in which if I fall into this, I'm letting that person down. I don't want to have that conversation. I don't want to talk about it with them. I just don't want to fall into it. You know, part of it is we're in this together. We're trying to pull each other together. And, you know, that's going to disappoint that person. That's going to hurt them. They're pouring all this time into me and I'm just going to sacrifice that like it doesn't matter. Or your future. The guy who is 19. What's one of your goals? Is to have a successful marriage. So what do you plan on doing? Just quitting your porn habit when you're engaged? When you're on your honeymoon? Doesn't work that way. Learning to count the cost. What is it that I have to lose here? Then finally, getting accountable. I am a big believer in this. Internet information technology has just turned into this burgeoning industry where it has made porn anonymous, it has made it accessible, and it's made it affordable. We need to do something as believers to counteract that whole venue for getting into porn. We need accountability. I haven't fallen into porn in years. I still have it. I still keep it. Now, for some accountability, there's blockers. You can get like a blocker that stops you from viewing, you know, they'll have it rated from highly mature to whatever, nothing, you know, email, something like that. I don't suggest blockers. And here's why. Because blockers actually, remember we talked about the thrill of the hunt, that I'm going to try and get at the picture, get at the video. The way the blockers work for the porno head is they're like, okay, I want to get at some porn, but I got this blocker. So do they just say, well, I got a blocker, so I guess I'm just not going to look at porn? Wrong. They'll spend 2 hours as a game trying to get around the blocker, which, of course, they always do. I worked with some guys on this as well. I said, so how did you do it? And they gave me a couple ways. Really creative stuff. I can't even explain to you how creative it was. That they were able to work through this. And it becomes kind of a game. It becomes kind of a thrill. It's almost like that pigeon with the lever. Okay, that gets blocked. Let's try it again. That gets blocked. Try it again. That gets blocked until finally you break through. What's better is some kind of a software that you download onto your computer. I suggest Covenant Eyes, which is terrific, or Ever Accountable. You could put that down there too. We've been running into issues when it comes to the smartphone. Covenant Eyes does not work. It is next to worthless for smartphones, at least for Apple. Having a really hard time with that. There are certain programs that you can lock down your stuff that are really high controlling. I think if it gets to be such an issue, you have to switch over to a different smartphone where you can get accountable. Maybe just give it up. You know, Jesus gives us the principle, if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. If you have to give up checking your Facebook on your phone, maybe you just want to surrender that right until you feel like you can actually do that without falling into porno. For extreme cases, I worked with one guy who was a real extreme case. What he did is he got on K9, which is actually used for businesses. And what you can do is have the internet get cut at a certain time. So he had discovered, I get into it at midnight or later. So he had his internet get cut at 10 o'clock and then turn back on at 6 in the morning when he'd be asleep. That's a possibility as well. But taking some kind of measure, I mean, guys, we're adults here. We know that if we're alone and if we get in our computer, we need something to keep us accountable. I think those of us who are walking with Christ know, I just don't trust myself in that kind of a situation. So get some help. Doing good? Okay, well, I know what you guys are thinking. You're like, we've been through all these subjects of counseling. Can we please talk about masturbation? Yes, we can. Yes, we can talk about masturbation. Your wish is my command. Your command is my whatever. Masturbation. What kind of an ethic should we develop on the subject of masturbation? We've taken a really hard stance against porn, and I think for good reason. For one, when the Bible says flee from lust, the term is porne. It was a junk drawer term in the first century, which is any kind of sexual activity with another person. Now, What should our stance be about masturbation? Now, you might think to yourself, well, why do we even need to talk about this? Well, for one, because everyone in this room is going to be thinking about it and questioning, are the two equivalent? You know, talking to people who are like, this week's been a really bad week. Why? Well, I fell into masturbation a couple times this week. Another guy, I fell into porn a couple times this week. What should be our ethic? What kind of a stance should we take on this? It's a question we should consider. First, we should ask ourselves this question. If masturbation is such a huge sin, something we should take a real stance on, why is it that it's never explicitly mentioned in the Bible? There's a couple examples. You have Genesis 38, where the guy is supposed to have sex with his dead brother's sister. I can't remember the names. I think it's Tamar, and I could be wrong. But he's supposed to impregnate her because she doesn't have kids. But instead of impregnating her, he, just to put it graphically, pulls out, and the way Genesis puts it in chapter 38, spills his seed on the ground. And so as a result, he's struck dead. And so many a fundamentalist preacher will say, and don't you spill your seed on the ground either, or you'll be struck dead, or at least go blind, you know, one or the other. Well, that's not really what that passage is teaching. The sin there isn't the contraception of pulling out. Otherwise, we would use the same argument against married couples who use that as a means of contraception. That's really talking about something totally different. It was, he was using her for sex, whereas he didn't want to impregnate her and help her. That's the context. You've got Leviticus 15, which says if any man, it's basically talking about nocturnal emissions. If you discover that you had a wet dream, you're unclean, ceremonially unclean. That'd be another example. There's one passage I could think of that actually talks about masturbation. Ecclesiastes 9, verse 10, whatever your hand finds to do, do with all your might. Everyone's looking up the context, like, is that really what that's saying? Mark Driscoll would quote that passage all the time. That always made me laugh. That's not talking about masturbation. The truth is, if you look at ethicists, theologians, people who write on this topic, they would agree. Feinberg and Feinberg, really conservative Christian ethicists. Mark Regnerus, very conservative Christian theologian. They'll agree masturbation isn't described in Scripture. Now, to me, that strikes me as a very conspicuous silence or a very conspicuous omission. When you look at Scripture, as you survey Scripture, it mentions every single kind of sexual immorality you could fathom. I mean, maybe I'm exaggerating. I guess it doesn't talk about everything, but it mentions fornication, adultery, homosexuality, incest, pederasty, pedophilia, lust, rape, bestiality. I mean, we're talking about a full, wide spectrum. I mean, pretty much every person I've ever known has masturbated in their lifetime. This is something that is ubiquitous across human culture. But Scripture never talks about that, but it even talks about some of these more aberrant sexual problems that people would have. So it mentions all that, but doesn't mention masturbation. Second, these descriptions cover the full range of possibilities, from the very serious to the very commonplace. I mean, we're talking about lust in your heart, not even doing anything about it internally versus, I mean, external abuse, violent sex, rape, or pedophilia. Now, somebody could counter and say, well, masturbation is closely connected with lust. I don't want to say one and the same, but one guy I was listening to said, if you masturbate and think about like a lawnmower or a car, that wouldn't be a sin. But if you're thinking about a lawnmower or a car while you masturbate, you have worse problems. Okay? So I guess I would just concede masturbation is closely connected with lust. It's, to put that a different way, it's nearly impossible to masturbate without lusting. On the other hand, we could point out one can also lust without masturbating. So what's the point? Well, the point I'm trying to reach here is if we're going to treat masturbation as a huge, discrediting, serious sin, whatever you want to call it, why isn't that we don't treat lust in the same category? After all, when Jesus talks about this, the topic he goes to is lust in Matthew 5. If you've lusted after your neighbor's wife, you've committed adultery. He doesn't talk about masturbation, but even in more inner heart attitude. Our position, which is a little bit controversial, is that we shouldn't treat this as a big deal for singles. Period. I think making this a big focus, talking about this all the time, this brings unnecessary guilt to single people. Most churches you go to, the singles are perpetually guilty, shameful about how much they masturbate or whatever. Now, most Christians don't have any kind of conviction about the fact that they haven't shared their faith in the past year, about how they don't have any fellow believers who are friends, lack of love, their materialism. They'll get the latest smartphone and have the newest car and everything else. But their conviction when they go to church and hear the pastor talk is, I masturbated this week. I need to repent before the Lord. And I think that's really a misplaced focus. That's a misemphasis if I've ever heard one. I would say that these are misplaced guilt feelings over masturbation. These probably cause more spiritual harm than the masturbation itself. Singles walking around feeling guilty all the time, not living in the light, that's probably worse than whatever masturbation could do to the person. Now, there are a few people who would agree with us, one of whom is James Dobson, Dr. James Dobson, president and founder of Focus on the Family. This is about as conservative a Christian as you can get, ultra-right-wing, nationally, internationally syndicated Christian radio show. This guy is about as hardcore Christian right as you can get. Here's what he says. He says, it is my opinion, as he's a psychologist also, it's my opinion that masturbation is not much of an issue with God. It is a normal part of adolescence, which involves no one else. It does not cause disease. It does not produce babies. And Jesus did not mention it in the Bible. It's kind of a good point. I'm not telling you to masturbate, neither am I, and hope you will not feel the need for it. I would agree. But if you do, it's my opinion that you should not struggle with guilt over it. I agree with that. Why do I tell you this? Because I deal with so many Christian young people who are torn apart with guilt over masturbation. They want to stop and just can't. I would like to help you avoid that agony. I feel that way too. Why is it that most of our conscience is afflicting us over this one issue that isn't even mentioned in the Bible? I've argued with people over this too. Some people just can't get past this. Well, it's a sin, right? Yeah, I mean, you're lusting. That's lust. It's a sin. So if it's wrong, it's wrong. Yeah, but we don't believe in just what's wrong. What we believe in is prioritized ethics or graded absolutism. We need to keep important issues over here and non-important issues over here. If we say if it's wrong, it's wrong, and every sin is a sin before God, that's true. But not, okay, all sins are equally sins. Not all sins are equally sinful. I've had people say, well, all sin is sin. No, that's not true at all. That's not what the Bible teaches. There's so many passages. You get a stricter judgment. Yeah, you get more of a reward. There will be less mercy for this. There will be, you just see. What about Jesus saying, you tithe mint, dill, and cumin, but you've neglected the weightier portions of the law. We believe in prioritized ethics. There was one guy in a Bible study who will remain nameless, who, when people were talking about their problems for the week, he started to share, you know, this week there was a stamp that was mailed on a letter, and it was mailed to me, but it was only like partially glued on. And so I just peeled it off and I licked the rest of it and I put it on my letter and then I mailed it out. And I just felt like, you know, that was just such a sin. I should not have done that. I stole from the government. You know, the guys in that Bible study were looking at him just like, who cares? It's 32 cents. Wasn't it a sin? Yeah, it was, I guess. Who cares? Get over it. You know, if we are going to be plagued with conviction over every single thing we do wrong, that is, okay, you know what that's kind of like? Have you ever met one of those really extroverted personalities, kind of ditzy, that they get a textbook and they take it home and the teacher says, okay, read the chapter and pull out your highlighter and highlight the important parts, and they're like, yeah, and they just keep highlighting until the whole book is highlighted. If everything is highlighted, nothing is highlighted. If we're going to say porn and masturbation are the same, no. I mean, I don't want to put a number on it. I was arguing with somebody over this. There's a home church leader, and I was just like, you know, I'm thinking like 500 to 1. That's my view. I'm not encouraging masturbation. I hope you get the point. But I am saying, let's not even put these two in the same category. Here's Richard Foster. He's a theologian. This is in the book. He has a particular chapter, Readings in Christian Ethics. He says, masturbation is not inherently wrong or sinful. In the main, it is a common experience for most people and should be accepted as a normal part of life. I think he's a little bit too strong there. That there's nothing. Again, if you're just doing it without lusting, but that's nearly impossible. And just because it's common doesn't make it right, but I get his point. Foster says, we simply must not lay impossible moral burdens upon people, especially when we have no specific biblical teaching against it in the Bible. This obsession is especially painful because one failure can cast a person into despair. It becomes a desperate all-or-nothing situation, and this is sad because it is completely unnecessary. We don't need to put people into impossible either-or binds. What we are after is control, balance, perspective. Yeah, if somebody said to me, so how much can I masturbate? I'd be like, that's the wrong question, okay? I'm not going to answer that. I'm not saying you should, and I'm not saying it's a good thing for you. We should actually treat excessive amounts more seriously, I guess. Going crazy on yourself all day, I don't think that's good. Self-love. We would say it's more serious for married people than for singles. In marriage, it's going to ruin your sex drive. You're not going to have enough to give out. In 1 Corinthians 7 says that your husband's body doesn't belong to him, it belongs to you. And your body doesn't belong to you, it belongs to your husband. This doesn't teach an on-demand view of sex, that's not the point. It's that we are supposed to submit to each other and be ready for each other. You know, going home and saying, well, I just don't feel like it. That's not the biblical view. I might not feel like it, but I'm here to show up to serve, even when I don't feel like it. So, if you're getting into masturbation when you're married, that's going to have an effect there. So I think it would increase the severity of it. All right, then we got to think about how to counsel heterosexual promiscuity. We teach on this topic so much, it comes up in Scripture so often, that I'm not going to devote a whole ton of time to this. What I'd like to do is kind of think of a case example, I guess we could put it, a case example, a case study. When you're working with somebody and they come to you and they say, hey, this week I slept with so-and-so. Or this week, this happened, that happened. What's your next move? What do you do? For some people, they moralize, they, you know, go through all the scriptures, that's really wrong, you're in, you know. For other people, it turns into like an encouragement circle. Oh, you're so brave for coming out with that. And it's like, no, it's like what? But what should our response be? It shouldn't be that we're affirming what they did. It shouldn't be that we're moralizing. I think there's a couple principles I would suggest. Let's think about these. When someone comes to you and says, this week or this month or whatever, I fell into sin with so-and-so. First thing you want to do is ask, how bad was it? You want to actually get at the facts. What was it? There was the case of the couple who said, one of them said, yeah, we've just been really struggling lately. We've been really feeling tempted with each other. And the guy was like, oh, okay, that's been hard. Yeah, but I think we're doing better. Okay. Only to discover the couple was getting buck naked with each other and touching each other, but not actually fornicating with each other. Okay, that's not being tempted. That's not struggling. That is bad, okay? Get the facts. What actually happened? That is sin, what you're describing. Okay, let's find out. Don't skip that part. These half-hearted confessions where we don't actually confess anything, it's kind of like a pseudo-confession where we don't actually get liberty from the issue. We only get liberty when we actually explain what happened. We don't need all the gory details, you know, but just, you know, how bad was it? How far did it go? I like to work with the person. Okay, so what led up to that? What was the thing that led up to that going down? Well, you know, this is where things were happening. Drank too much, or I went over to her house, no one's home, or in the basement. Okay, so that's what led up to it. How did you feel after it went down? If you can kind of get them into the before and the after effects, that kind of gives you a basis for getting the conversation going. Here, you would want to appeal to Scripture. I do think that is important. We're trying to communicate here. It's not that this is my issue with you. It's that you now have an issue with God. Your position with God, your identity with God, doesn't change at all. That is completely the same. Your condition with God, that does change. You can't say, well, I'm just going to keep getting into sin, fornication, and that's not going to change my relationship with God. It does change your relationship with God. Not your identity, not your forgiveness, not your spot in eternity, that doesn't change. But your condition with them does change. And we got to move. Let's get out of this. Appealing to Scripture. Another question you can ask the person. So what steps are you planning on taking to stop this from happening again? Here, I don't really like to make suggestions. I like to put the ball in their court. They're an adult. You know, what are you going to do to stop this from happening? I mean, this happened before. How do we know it's not going to happen a second time or a third? What's going to be different? Well, this time I'm just going to try even harder. No, that's not going to change. What are you going to do? What choices are you going to make to change this? You also want to encourage mature same-sex relationships. For the guy who shows up at your house church, who just says, well, I don't really have other guy friends. I just relate better with women. More often we get this with girls. I don't have girlfriends. They're too catty. They're too snobby. They talk behind your back. My best friends are guys. When you hear that, that is a sign of serious relational deficiency. You need to be able to bond with people of your own sex, not people that when you bond with them, you get some kind of feeling or emotion out of it. Flirting, relational intimacy. When it's somebody you're not attracted to, but you can bond with them, often the closeness, the pseudo-intimacy that you're getting with sexual sin, it can be offset when that relational need is being met with people of the same sex. When you have warmth, when you have intimacy, when you have closeness, or to put that a different way, when my whole life is based around her, that she is my best relationship in my life, and I'm going to cut out that whole big portion of my life, which is the closest intimacy, the sex with her, what is going to replace that vacuum? If people can't look over and see, well, deep friendship and community and love and warmth, if there's nothing to replace it, we're not going to be able to win people out of this lifestyle because they just can't even fathom what it would be like to shut down that area of the relationship. Also, encourage further transparency. I do like to encourage the person in the sense that I'm really happy you shared that. You made the right decision. You're under grace. But it's different than just saying, oh, I fell into sin this week, and the person just says, cool. It's not cool. You need to address it and actually move in rather than just kind of being paralyzed and not knowing what to say. So did everyone get those steps? I don't feel like this is like a real dogmatic 1, 2, 3. I didn't number them. I just think those are some steps you can take. We're also going to have to counsel people who have been abused. Working with people with abuse is difficult, but many people have been abused. You look at the statistics on this. Looking at websites is a little bit questionable, but then you do have some good websites that have pretty good statisticians and sociologists. I've heard 20% of adult women were victims of child abuse or incest. Then I've also heard 40% of women have been raped in adulthood. That is a lot. It's a whole lot. And many men. I've heard different statistics. The thing with men, many men just don't talk about it. If they've been raped or abused or if there was any kind of incest, women are more forthright to come out with this. So the statistics for women could be higher in the sense that many men don't have friends that they can talk about this with. They don't have people they can open up with, and they just decide to never think about it, never talk about it. 76% of abusers, those who perpetrate abuse, are also themselves abused or were themselves abused. Many people who are in this situation have been abused. That's where they learned it. So abuse is kind of a vicious cycle. When we think of incest and molestation in particular, these are a little bit more confusing because incest and molestation, in some cases, you work with people where the incest or the molestation, an older person with a younger, it was voluntary. I'm not saying it was right, right? And I'm not saying that the kid was culpable. I'm not saying that either. What I'm saying is when the sexual activity happened with the youth, they enjoyed it. They liked it. It felt good. It brought pleasure. If incest, you know, between family members, cousins, brother, sister, brother, brother, if this is voluntary, it can lead to tremendous promiscuity later in life. It's basically like the case of, can't even share that story. You see cases where you see rampant incest or you see an obsession with sex with kids, and you have to wonder, there must have been something that was imprinted there. You don't just have 10-year-old kids doing this kind of stuff. They learned it from somewhere. You know what I'm saying? Mark Lasser describes this in his book, Healing the Wounds of Sexual Addiction. He says, it may also be that adults who offend in this way repeat their childhood abuse because it reconnects to them to the first time their sexual awareness was aroused. And so 76% of people who give abuse were themselves abused because that was their first sexual experience. Lasser says this is called imprinting. When adults continue to act out what was imprinted on them as children, they may be returning to their original feelings of sexual excitement. So if it's voluntary, if it was, I'm not going to say it was good, but it was pleasurable, this can lead to promiscuity. If it was involuntary, if there was something done to the person, incest or molestation, later in life, this can lead to frigidity and general aversion to sex. You were touched inappropriately. You did something inappropriate. You didn't like it. You didn't want to do it. You were forced to do it. This can lead to frigidity. Now, I'm being very careful with my words. I'm not saying if it was voluntary, it will lead to promiscuity or it will lead to frigidity. Gary Collins makes this point. He says, some people are just resilient and you keep waiting for the boom to fall and for the, you know, the pieces to shatter. And some people, I think it's a temperamental thing where they just kind of rebound and they have a resilience about them. For the rest of us, it's going to affect us in a number of different ways. And the quicker we can address these issues without ignoring them, but actually facing them, forgiving, confronting, doing whatever we need to do, getting this out there, it's going to help. Collins notes this as well. He says, the majority of abused children do not reveal their experiences during childhood. And when they do admit abuse, it is common for them to later deny that it really happened. Why? Because most kids who say, this happened with my cousin, or this happened with my uncle, or my grandpa. You know, it's a young kid, there's an adult, he's a family member, he's trusted, and then you got a kid. Many of the parents will go into denial. No, not Uncle So-and-so, or not your cousin, no, that never happened. What are you talking about? That never would have happened. And so they can actually turn on the kid. And the kid's trying to come out with it and talk about it, doesn't have the faculties to stand up for himself. And so this leads to the kid actually just repressing it, not talking about it, until later in life, somebody starts explaining something about this and all of a sudden they click and they go, oh, yeah, that happened to me. I remember that. At the same time, what we should avoid, and this is important, I want you to pay attention here. When we talk to people whom we think may have been abused, we ask them this. To the best of your knowledge, do you ever remember abuse? Can you remember something that happened where you felt like you were abused? That's what we ask. Do you know what we never, ever, ever say? I think that you were abused. This can lead to false memory syndrome. False memory syndrome was a phenomenon that appeared at the end of the 1980s. There was a whole school of psychotherapy that was convinced that if you couldn't remember abuse, the counselor had to help you remember it. And everything was suppressed and repressed. And so through hypnosis or the urging of the counselor, they actually had convinced people that they had been sexually abused, and they never were. My professor he's in the field, Christian counseling, PhD. He was involved in a court case where the woman said, he raped me. It was behind the sign at the corner of so-and-so and such-and-such. My professor had to go appear in a court of law and said, I don't think that ever happened, because he went and visited that corner and there was no sign. He said, what did the sign look like? Oh, it was a big billboard. It looked like this. And he raped me behind there. He went there and looked. There was no sign. There had never been a sign. This came out with multiple thousands of cases where this whole school of psychology was convincing people that they had been abused, because the memory of a human being is very fluid and you can place ideas on people's minds. And it's kind of like that movie Inception, where you start to talk about it to the point where they start to believe that they were there. Has that ever happened with you, where you're, you know, maybe you and a loved one were somewhere and they tell the story so much you feel like you were there and you weren't there? There was thousands of cases back in the early 1990s where this would happen, where people would go to their parent and say, you raped me, you abused me. The parent would say, I never abused you, I never raped you. And the people would say, I'm not going to talk to you until you can admit what you did. And so this ripped apart families, well, they finally caught up with this, discovering thousands of cases were falsified. Families were ripped apart. We never want to be guilty of this. Now, in these cases I'm describing were pretty extreme, because they were using hypnosis. If you've ever seen the show The X-Files, you know The X-Files, Agent Mulder, you know, when did that show first debut? Early 90s, when this was coming to the surface. And so he's always going through hypnosis to discover repressed memories of aliens stealing his sister. That's kind of what this was all about. Trying to, if we can't remember things, we need to search for them and try and remember and try and discover, because it's all repressed. So it's going to be pretty bad. We don't ever want to be guilty of this. We don't want to say, you're showing these signs and I think you were raped or I think you were abused. Instead, you just ask, can you remember any abuse? And we don't have to worry that we're going to fake a memory or something. Just think, can I remember abuse? If you can't remember, if you were abused and you can't remember, maybe it's God's mercy that you can't. How about that? Most of the bad things in my life I can't remember, I'm happy for. So we don't want people to go back and search for this kind of thing. In the case of rape, this happens quite a bit. Many women have endured this. This is considered a violent crime because it's actually holding someone down to the will to power. It's a violent act. I don't have too much research on this, and so I'm not going to pretend like I do. I haven't counseled too many people with this. Maybe in future years I will, but I'm just going to give you the stuff I do know. It's good. First, help the woman or man work through the notion of self-blame. Let me give one example. This is a little bit, you know, graphic, but that's the nature of the subject. For the woman who's out at 3 in the morning at the bar, short skirt, cleavage showing, walking home with high heels, dressed seductively, gets raped. She could actually blame herself, saying, I deserved it because I put myself in that situation. And that's not true. Should you put yourself in that situation as a lady? Absolutely not. Protect yourself. Be safe, okay? You get that, right? But what we should never say is that because you dressed a certain way, you deserved to have a violent crime done to you. That is apples and oranges. I don't think you should do that in the future, but that has nothing to do with the crime that happened. Helping people work through that self-blame. It wasn't your fault. That was his fault. That was evil. Help victims, just like anything else, see that they're victors in Christ. That God can take this. He can pick you up. He can rescue you from this and change you. Help with healthy boundaries. Maybe that person, most of the time, rape happens from people that you know. It's not that scene I just described of a woman going out to the club late at night. It's usually a friend, co-worker. It's someone you know who rapes you. So if there's examples where the girl or the guy is still in their life, don't get near them. You need to help them. Yeah, you can forgive that person. That doesn't mean that you trust that person. And all I can say is get help. Get a pro counselor on the phone. One thing I want to impart to you guys is this. When you are in over your head and you're working with someone and you don't understand, get on the phone with somebody. Call for help. Talk to me about it. Email me. I got a situation. I don't know what to do. That doesn't bother me, but I can't help if you don't contact me. Talk to a pro counselor. Do some study. All that material on porno I laid out tonight, I never studied that until I was working with a dude that was a porn addict. And then I went through and read half a dozen books and articles and teachings, and you start to, and it's because you care about your friend and you're trying to help. So do the study, get help, do what you can. Okay, any quick questions? Great point. Do you hear that? Rape jokes. How about comments you make where you're watching a movie where a girl gets raped and you say, oh, that's disgusting. Makes me sick to watch. And, you know, that can be easily misinterpreted. That I'm disgusting. I'm sick to watch. You should be very sensitive with that kind of stuff. When you eventually get to the point where you're going to get married, usually you don't disclose this kind of stuff when you first start dating. That's a little bit too much information. When it's getting down to the point where, you know, you express your love for each other, you're getting engaged, that's when you start to talk about this kind of history. And the reason you do it is so that your spouse can be sensitive to you and help you work through that during engagement, so that when you get to the point where you get married, you have somebody who's on the same team. Yeah. Where would you sort of start with help? I think the best way to think of it is this, is just saying, when you can't talk about this, I want you to picture like you're in a room where the room is closing in on you. And it's just forming pressure and pressure and pressure and pressure and pressure. And it's not until you open up and talk about it that it releases that pressure. But if you just keep this all to yourself, it's just going to be like a pressure cooker until you pop. And the way to release it is just to verbalize and talk through this. And if you won't do that, you're the one who's going to suffer, not me. This isn't some voyeuristic thing where I want to find out all about this. It's for your benefit. I want to be a listening ear. I care. And I'm just here to help. And we can go at your pace. Whenever you want to talk about it, that's fine. You know, I'm not going to press. I have in a couple situations of abuse pressed. You know, I know you mentioned abuse. Just get it off your chest. Here's your opportunity. Just talk about it. It's not that bad. You know, I don't mean that it's not that bad. It's not that uncommon. You're not the only one. 1 Corinthians 10:13. There's no temptation which has seized you which is not common to man. There's people around you who have been right through the same thing. Let's get the help we need.